free improvisation. Freely improvised music, variously called total improvisation, open improvisation, free music, or perhaps often simply improvised music, suffers from and enjoys a confused identity. The two regular confusions which blur its identity are to associate it with experimental music or with avant-garde music. But freely improvised music has no stylistic or idiomatic commitment, no prescribed idiomatic sound, and it's established only by the sonic musical identity of the person or persons who are playing it. Einstein looked upon improvisation as an emotional and intellectual necessity and reported enjoying improvisation on his piano throughout his life. Two important pieces of reading about free improvisation are Leo Smith's Notes, 8 Pieces, and Cornelius Cardew's Towards an Ethic of Improvisation. They're totally different from each other, however. Cardew maintains that it's an outgrowth of European philosophy and of indeterminate composition, whereas Smith talks about it being an extension of jazz. But both documents speak about how the musician of integrity was wishing for a direct, unadulterated involvement of the music, and free improvisation was the obvious escape from the rigidity and formalism of their respective musical backgrounds. Opinions about free music are plentiful and differ widely, but the simplest thing in the world, requiring no explanation, is to view that it is complicated beyond discussion. And from the view that it requires no instrumental skill at all, to it having to be a highly sophisticated personal technique of virtuosic dimensions. The author's group, Joseph Holbrook, originally was mimicking contemporary jazz developments from people like Bill Evans, John Coltrane, Eric Dolphy, and Albert Ayler, and also as a reflection of contemporary composers such as Messiaen, Boulez, Stockhausen, and John Cage. And it was a more emotional or instinctive search to find something that was logical and right, or at least appropriate, to replace the inherited things which we found stilted, moribund, and formal. Initially, they played jazz standards and superimposed a different time feel until the feeling of a regular pulse was totally removed. And then harmonic experiments started taking place. And we were listening to Scott LaFaro and John Coltrane, and there were attacks on harmonic and rhythmic frameworks which we were working with. But eventually we did break those frameworks, but only gradually through wholesale moves, not all at once. The first was to break the meter down. Our earliest free improvisations had a definite modal orientation, except of course it wasn't free, it was modal. The thing about music was that it was most marked in the fact that silence was valid. The music started from silence, and it didn't start from the rhythm section, quote, getting it on. I felt that I was involved in a universal language. The early developments followed contemporary jazz developments, but after a while it became anti-jazz, and after that was a complete ignoring of possible jazz aspects in the playing. There were influences from John Cage's Silence, and Messiaen and his work called Chronochromie and L'Ascension. We spent a lot of attention individually and collectively on single sounds. There was very tight concentration, almost a zen quality in the music. And then in the author's band Music Improvisation Company, which followed, quote, when improvising musicians know each other well enough for a common language to have come into being, and a mutual trust in each other permits one to push against the limitations of that language and the relationship on which it is based, then musicians can choose to support or challenge each other in the moment. The attitude of the player to this tactile element, to the physical experience of playing an instrument, to the instrumental impulse, establishes much of the way he plays. Studying formally with a teacher might be the right way to achieve certain specific aims, but to do only that is a very distorted way of approaching a musical instrument. It has to be realized that a person's own investigation of an instrument, his exploration of it, is totally valid. Technique for the improviser is a direct attunement with the mental, spiritual, and mechanical energies necessary to express a full creative impulse. An extension of technique might have had certain musical implications. There also seems to be a direct technical benefit from a concentration on the creative, not the executive side of playing. And more percussion instruments found its way into modern classical music, like woodblocks, xylophones, etc., supplemented by gongs, saucepans, gun shells, handbells, and even the modern composer Luigi Russolo used to describe his noisemakers as howlers, roarers, cracklers, whistlers, rubbers, buzzers, exploders, gurglers, and rustlers. The technical illusions practiced in recording, either live or in the studio, are inimical to the constantly changing balances and roles which operate within most free improvisation. Recording is indeed the same playing, but divorced from its natural contexts. Lionel Salter says, "I'm not at all sure that recording is useful for anything more than reference. A record gives us only a frozen or fixed moment, like a photograph of a dancer." Playing free improvisation solo. In the choice and development of material, the solo improviser works in similar ways to group improviser, building a personal vocabulary and working it to extend in both performance and in preparation. The improviser can look for material which will be appropriate for and which will facilitate improvisation. For the soloist, there's an even greater loss potential because of the unpredictable element, and so language becomes much more important. When other more aesthetically acceptable resources such as invention and imagination have gone missing, the vocabulary becomes the sole means of support, and it has to sustain continuity and impetus in the musical performance, wherein the main danger in solo improvisation arises. Improvising alone before an audience is not without its terrors. A successful audience response can be the cause of rituals and formulae being repeatedly trotted out long after they have lost any musical motivation. At this point, the credibility of the activity is in the balance, and maintaining it simply depends on the courage of the player. Schoenberg's pre-serial free atonal period and the later music of Webern were influential. The author says, "I was looking to utilize those elements which stem from the concepts of unpredictability and discontinuity, of perpetual variation and renewal, first introduced into European composition at the beginning of the 20th century. But this improvising language was, of course, superimposed upon another musical language, one learned also empirically over many years as a working musician. Once a vocabulary of some homogeneity is assembled, material can be included, at least for a period, from any source. A feeling of freshness is essential, and the best way to get that is for some of the material to be fresh. In a sense, it is change for the sake of the benefits that change can bring. For the improviser, the physicality of producing good sound, the hardware, is not a separate activity to the thoughts and ideas in music, the software. The thoughts and decisions are sustained and modified by a physical component, and vice versa. But as soon as I try to define these separately, I run into problems. It's the very entanglement of these levels of perception, awareness, and the physicality that makes improvisation. Solo playing is a vehicle for self-expression. It's, to quote Paul Klee, taking a line for a walk. Sometimes solo players such as Hans Reichel build a series of instruments uniquely designed for each particular piece that it is to be played on them. To practice solo improvisation, the author divides it into three parts: the technical practice, and then second would be areas that deal specifically with manipulative demands made by the new material, and third, woodshedding, which is a bridge between technical practice and improvisation. Playing might be much the same as when improvising, but the focus of attention will be on the details of playing rather than on the totality, which is what is being exercised in practice. Adverse criticism of free improvisation is almost always that it is formless, its formlessness. The necessity for design and balance is nowhere more imperative than in music, where all is so fleeting and impalpable, mere vibrations of the tympanic membrane. But improvisers seem to prefer formlessness. More accurately, they prefer the music to dictate its own form. Improvisation makes its own form. Carl T. Whitmer says, in expansion, the form is generated. Improvisation has meant the freeing of form that it may more readily accommodate than imagination, says Frank Perry. Whatever the advantages to solo playing, there is a whole side to improvisation, the more exciting, the more magical side, which can only be discovered by people playing together. Possible musical dimensions of group playing far outstrip those of solo playing. The best base from which to approach group playing is that of being a solo improviser. Having solo playing as an ultimate resource, then, it is possible to play with other musicians. As often as one wishes without having to enter into permanent commitment to any stylistic or aesthetic position.